like counterparts.
When one takes a look at racism, there are instances of it that are either repeated or built upon from the past. And of course, this comes at an economic cost. These are some of the instances that prevent economic contribution from minorities, be it African Americans or Latinos. Take public education. This has actually been underfunded in many African American majority schools. As a result, skill acquisition and upward mobility is prevented. Employment discrimination happens in different forms, which makes it hard to escape things like poverty. And then there is the criminal justice system, higher incarceration rates for minorities, there are also higher guilty verdicts, even higher bail money, and greater chances of monetary sanctions. Employment discrimination among minorities is worth taking a look at, since there are many jobs that are characteristics of this group. Taking a look at this chart, it shows occupations with a high black worker concentration. The lowest is childcare workers, coming in at 17%. Home health aides, nursing assistants, security guards, and bus drivers are the higher ranking ones. But take a note at the average median wage, which falls below the standard wage. Compared to whites, the median wage for all US workers is around $42,000 per year. But 43% of black workers earn less than $30,000 annually. And take a look at the black share of the labor force, 12.9%. And here's something not reported or known in the US. Many black neighborhoods don't have sufficient access to goods and services that are taken for granted in other everyday white majority neighborhoods. One out of every five black households is situated in a food desert, defined by the USDA as a low-income neighborhood with inadequate access to food. In terms of housing, blacks have 53.7% of their income go toward housing, when the average should be 30%. When it comes to healthcare, black Americans are nearly 2.4 times more likely than white Americans to live in a neighborhood with limited healthcare services. And in terms of banking, bank branches have been closing rapidly in recent years. And according to FDIC, nearly half of all black households did not have enough banks in 2017, compared to just 20% of white households. Our final look is on the internet availability to minorities, especially blacks. This is a big one, since its effect is felt on a wide scale of US economic activity. When it comes to broadband, black households are 50% more likely to live in areas with limited broadband service. And many internet service providers impose credit checks or require cash deposits from new customers. This is why black consumers are more likely to participate in e-commerce, since they are a segment that has become mobile first compared to the whites. If you feel we have left anything out, please let us know. We would love to hear from you. From me, Mahdi, it's goodbye until next week.
The problem of racial inequality in the U.S., particularly against African Americans and Latinos, is deep-rooted. As our guests have pointed out, some of this goes back to the days of slavery in the case of African Americans. But so what? Does that mean that the status quo in the U.S. continue? U.S. officials in charge, like the current President Joe Biden and even the Federal Reserve, know that minorities have been held back in the U.S., as shown in the study that we revealed to you, and that they can greatly contribute to U.S.'s economic GDP. But how can that happen when you are looking at a greatly divided U.S., perhaps more than at any other time in U.S. history? That's something to think about. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you on board. Hope you enjoyed it. From Mikova Tafoyi and the entire team at Economic Dividers, goodbye. Until next time.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. I am now in south of Iran, in the beautiful province of Hormozgan. This province is usually known by its important strategic ports like Bandar Lenge, Bandar Abbas, or the beautiful islands of Kish, Kesh, Mbu Musa, the Greater Tomb and the Lesser Tomb, as well as Hengam. However, you might get surprised to hear that Hormozgan is one of the mountainous regions of southern Iran, which is home to unique, amazing hikes. Today, I'm going to take you to Shotariku Canyon. Stay with me. Hormozgan province is the eighth vast province of Iran. This vast province is located in the proximity of the Persian Gulf and north of the Strait of Hormuz. Shotariku Canyon is one of the spectacular natural places of this province. This canyon is located in a village called Chakchak. Shotariku in English means dark night, and that's because of the fact that in order to enter this canyon, you have to pass through a dark cave. The mountains of Shotariku, like most of the mountains of southern Iran, have different amazing appearances. These mountains have light-colored coarse appearance with several dents caused by hard erosion of these heights. The coarse shape of these heights seems to be horrible at the first glance. In the middle of these heights, there is a coarse rocky canyon, which has a seasonal river flowing through it. However, sometimes because of lack of precipitation and high temperature, no river exists. In order to hike this coarse, punishing canyon, you have to pass over several rocks, so you'd better be accompanied by a tour guide. I am now in Chakchak village. My backpack is ready and I have filled my flask with cool fresh water. A kind local woman of this village just gave me some fresh date, which I have put it in my backpack. I'm totally prepared to have a tour to Shotariku Canyon. To be honest, I'm very excited.
how much distance I've covered to this point. I have to take a rest. I'm really thirsty. I'm okay now. Oh, it's so beautiful here. On my both sides, there are tall mountains, each side of them with a different color. Oh, very beautiful. I've reached the two-way road. The right path ends in Shotariko, and the left path ends in Odabe, which is a more twisting way. I choose the right path. Oh my god, here is full of green bushes. It's interesting to note that most of the plants in this region have medicinal effects. Oh, what a pity. I don't have any knowledge about these herbs. The shape of the rocks here is very strange, and they're filled with moss, so I have to be more careful to walk, otherwise I will slip over them. I am now inside the canyon. The weather is cool. There are different birds in here, which their singing can be heard in every corner of the canyon. They sing beautifully. Oh my god, it's gorgeous. There are some pits in here which have green or azure colored water. The reflection on the walls of the rocks is astonishing. Oh, the movement of the water and the calm in here have made this atmosphere very mysterious, as if I'm in a dream. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Liberal Democrats, 17,957.
In another setback for the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, his Conservative Party has lost its North Shropshire seat to Liberal Democrats in a by-election, the constituency the Tories dominated for nearly 200 years. In her victory speech, Helen Morgan said the results reflect the British people's views about the Conservative Party.
Tonight, the people of North Shropshire have spoken on behalf of the British people. They've said loudly and clearly, Boris Johnson, the party is over.
The Liberal Democrats, in my view, have never been an alternative to the Conservative Party. They're really there's very little difference between the policies of the Liberal Democrats and Conservatives. In other words, when the Conservatives lose credibility, they bring out the Liberal Democrats, who are sort of centrist, never represented any concrete or coherent alternative to the Conservative Party.
Conservative lawmaker Roger Gale also says the by-election can be regarded as a referendum on the Prime Minister's performance. The by-election was called after the former MP for North Shropshire stepped down for breaching the Parliament's paid lobbying rules. The British government tried to avert the resignation by changing the rules, but later faced a backlash and was forced to backtrack. That was only one in the long list of issues raising questions about Boris Johnson's leadership. Opposition politicians accused Johnson of being a serial liar and incompetent leader, with some demanding that he resign.
Clearly, the vote in North Shropshire.
Boris Johnson acknowledged that the shocking results of the North Shropshire by-election contained a message for him and his party.
I'm responsible for everything that the government does. And of course, I take personal responsibility.
But there's too much responsibility to shoulder, as Boris Johnson's tenure has been replete with a spate of allegations and scandals. The Premier stands accused of breaking the law by using Conservative Party donations to renovate his residence at No. 11 Downing Street. He's also under pressure for reported parties in his office last Christmas, disregarding the very COVID-19 restrictions the government had imposed. British dailies The Guardian and The Independent have also reported that Boris Johnson himself joined a pizza party in Downing Street in May last year, amid the first nationwide lockdown. The Premier is also under fire for his handling of the pandemic. On Tuesday, he suffered a humiliating rebellion from Conservative lawmakers over measures to curb the spread of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. In addition, damaging disclosures have surfaced about some of the Conservative MPs who've moonlighted as political consultants or advisors, raking in tens of thousands of pounds by lobbying. The metaphorical pendulum in Britain's domestic politics appears to be swinging to the other side. The Conservatives have a couple of years to stop that from happening.
Inflation in the UK has risen to its highest level in 10 years. The cost of living has surged by 5.1% in the 12 months to November, up from 4.2% the month before. This was the steepest increase for a decade, and more than doubles the central bank's target. Increase in costs for fuel, energy, clothing, and secondhand cars were indicative of the rise in inflation. Economists had expected an inflation of 4.7% for the month of November, and the Bank of England had projected that inflation would hit 5% in the spring of 2022. Before moderating towards its 2% target in late 2023.
We haven't seen inflation at this level for many decades. The highest level I can remember actually was back in the 1970s when it reached 25%. So 5% is still very high, but nothing near that level. But it's still double the level that the Bank of England expected, of just over about 2.5%. And so it's going to be very difficult to try and adjust to it. Now the question is, of course, is this going to be embedded inflation and carries on, as we saw in the 1970s, or is it just rolled off after 12 months because of individual price increases?
It is believed that global supply chain problems, staff shortages, and rapid demand for oil and gas have all driven up prices. The end of COVID support schemes and Brexit have also played a part. In November, petrol prices jumped to the highest ever recorded, while the cost of used cars jumped due to shortages of new vehicles. The UK fuel poverty has further increased due to the increase in energy costs, putting further strain on the average UK family.
And those supply chain issues take a long time to work their way through. Most recently, we had, for instance, a shortage of lorry drivers. and only now we're beginning to see our way through the other side of that. So that's taken 3 or 4 months to work its way through. Other issues of supply chain will be much longer, as a lot of businesses will try and shorten their supply routes, supply chains, and de-risk their supply chains, and that means more localization, local product production, and maybe less trade coming out of, say, the Far East and other areas like that. So global trade was designed in such a way, it was like an elastic band, very efficient and very taut, but unfortunately when that elastic band breaks, it's very difficult to replace quickly.
The rising inflation has sparked an outcry from Britain's Unite Trade Union. This says many workers face an effective pay cut with the prospect of below-inflation annual wage increases. The Unite Union has urged companies to grant pay hikes that preserve the buying power salary.
But what we've seen, obviously, is oil price rising, particularly gas. And unfortunately for the British public, they've got a nasty shock coming in the spring when the government-imposed cap on the gas price is taken off. And a lot of people see their prices of gas nearly double in value, which is going to be very painful for them indeed. So this is working its way through the system. We're going to see higher wage rises coming through. And this has particularly hit people at the weaker end of society, those who are poorer paid. Well, if nothing else, it means they're going to get paid more, but unfortunately, not in real terms, because even if you get a 4% pay rise, which has been suggested for many, when you've got inflation at over 5%, you're still losing money.
Current estimates suggest that costs for the typical UK family will jump by £1,700 in the year 2022. But Labour claimed the government is not doing nearly enough to tackle the problem, especially as further inflationary pressures from rising energy costs are coming down the line. Omicron, which emerged late last month, forced Britain to reimpose coronavirus restrictions that were passed by lawmakers late on Tuesday. The UK economy was already struggling prior to the arrival of Omicron, growing by 0.1% in October from 0.6% in September. The International Monetary Fund warned Tuesday that new COVID-19 variants pose downside risks to the outlook for Britain, urging the government to consider new emergency stimulus measures in the event of fresh lockdowns. The IMF predicted inflation would reach around 5.5% early next year, its highest in 30 years, and warned the bank not to succumb to inaction bias. Economists have warned that the supply chain disruptions will continue to disrupt economic activity, leading to sharp price increases at least for the year 2022. This phenomenon is not unique to just the UK. The US and many other parts of the world are also suffering from inflation, from food prices to energy costs.
After a chaotic end to its disastrous war in Afghanistan, failure of America's longest military mission is fueling a heated debate about U.S. militarism. The war dragged on for 2 decades and cost American taxpayers over $2.3 trillion. Thousands of American troops lost their lives, and many more were injured in the protracted military campaign that's been widely described as a fiasco. The war wreaked havoc on Afghanistan, with tens of thousands of civilians losing their lives or limbs. On August the 30th, the United States withdrew from Afghanistan after a terrible loss to the enemy it invaded Afghanistan to defeat. There is absolutely no doubt that the Afghan mission ended in failure. Afghanistan was the first country attacked by America as part of its so-called war on terror, launched by former President George W. Bush. Almost none of the stated goals of the Afghan mission were ever fulfilled. In late September, America's highest-ranking general, Chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley, said during a Senate hearing that the U.S. pullout with the Taliban back in power is quote-unquote a strategic failure.
America's weakness has been exposed to the world. I mean, essentially, America's incompetence, its military weakness, its lack of foresight, was exposed as a result of the chaotic pullout of Afghanistan. It was shown that America had no idea why it was there. It had no clear goals. It lacked the military means for subduing the Taliban. And all it could do was spread destruction. So that is essentially exposes the incredible weakness of the American empire.
many Americans are still looking for answers. What brought their country to this part of the world? And what kept it fighting a futile war for two decades? Meanwhile, the U.S. is definitely not taking responsibility for the mess that it left behind in this volatile region as huge waves of Afghan refugees overwhelm neighboring countries and beyond. The United States has fought many wars during its history. Over the past decades, most U.S. military missions have been criticized for not going as planned. The Afghan mission became particularly notorious for lack of strategy and proper planning. U.S. lawmakers have launched a commission to study the Afghanistan fiasco. This week, the U.S. Congress voted to set up a commission to assess the failures during the 20-year war. The commission was part of an annual military package passed by the Senate on Wednesday after approval last week by the House of Representatives. The bipartisan commission on Afghanistan will have 16 members. It faces a deadline to issue an initial report within a year of its first meeting, and a final report within 3 years. The legislation said, quote, "The commission shall conduct a comprehensive assessment of the war in Afghanistan and make recommendations to inform future operations with tactical and strategic lessons learned, including the impact of troop increases and decreases, and date certain deadlines." The congressional panel will also study George W. Bush's launch of the war, as well as American policy on Afghanistan in the years before the mission.
We can be rest assured it will be unperceptive, unanalytical, and unintelligent. That seems to be quite clear. The U.S. is incapable of learning. It's incapable of learning from its past mistakes. It's destined to keep on making the same mistakes over and over again.
The United States seems to be reflecting on its longest war months after the chaotic pullout. Will it learn from its long list of failures in Afghanistan?
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has officially visited the United Arab Emirates, becoming the first sitting Israeli premier to visit the Persian Gulf country. On Monday, he met with senior UAE officials, including Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. In a joint statement, the two said they discussed several areas of cooperation, including trade, technology, the environment, and tourism, as well as forming a joint research and development fund. Abu Dhabi and Tel Aviv established diplomatic relations last September under a U.S. brokered agreement. That deal also saw Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco normalize their ties with Israel. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad Resistance Movement has strongly condemned the Emirati officials over receiving the Israeli Prime Minister, stressing that any normalization and alliance with the Tel Aviv regime amounts to betrayal of Palestine.
Well, you see, the monarch of the UAE, the royal family, are not really concerned about what's in the best interests of the region or of the Arab nation. They don't care about the people of the UAE. They don't care about the people of Palestine. And they don't care about the Arab. They certainly don't care about the Arab nation. So they're doing what they're doing because of how they perceive they will survive and prosper.
The trip has already drawn condemnation from the Palestinian Liberation Organization. It says the visit violates the Arab consensus that's supposed to support the Palestinian cause amid challenges imposed by Israel. Meanwhile, a member of the Palestinian Fatah Movement's Central Committee said the United Arab Emirates must be expelled from the Arab League due to normalization with Israel. The United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia have recently appeared to have changed track in their foreign policies, making overtures to nations they had previously severed ties with. Last month, the Emirati foreign minister drew the ire of the United States by meeting with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in capital Damascus. The UAE's senior national security advisor met his Iranian counterpart Ali Shamkhani and President Ebrahim Raisi in a rare visit to Iran earlier this month, a move that's said to have aimed at overcoming long-standing differences between the two sides.
They see the U.S. defeats in Afghanistan, a disorderly rout, actually. They see that the U.S. is going to have to pull out of Iraq. They see that the U.S. regime change operation has been defeated in Syria, almost. And they see that the people of Yemen are defeating their staunch ally, Saudi Arabia. So they are like rats on a sinking ship, looking for a way to save themselves.
The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, however, is now warning that the presence of Israel in the Persian Gulf region will only lead to increased tensions as a result of the Zionist regime's Iranophobic policies. In the meantime, Iran's foreign ministry says people in West Asia have not forgotten the, quote, vicious and vindictive actions of Israel, describing the regime as a root cause of problems in the region. Iran has repeatedly called for regional efforts to maintain stability and security, while warning that external elements can't bring peace to West Asia.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Besides defending geographical borders, martyrs defend religious, spiritual, and cultural borders.
This is part of the speech delivered on November 21st, 2021, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials in charge of conducting the Martyrs of Ilam commemoration ceremony.
فشار دشمن و فشار جنگ نتوانسته از بروز استعدادهای این مردم چیزی کم کنه. خیلی مهم.
The pressures brought by the enemy and the war could not stop the people of this province from showing their talents. This is very important. People like the dear martyr, Martyr Rezai Nejad, have a high spiritual status as well as a scientific status. The reason for their high spiritual status is the fact that they were martyred, because martyrdom is not achieved easily. Martyrdom and obtaining this rank requires the existence of certain prerequisites in the nature and actions of individuals. Without these prerequisites, martyrdom is not granted to anyone. That young scientist possessed that high spiritual status, and that was why he was martyred. Otherwise, one will not become a martyr without these qualities.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. nations should be united.
یک نکته مهم این است که خب گفته میشه که 3000 اندی شهید استان ایلام تقدیم کرده و استانهای دیگه هم هر کدوم به فراخور جمعیت و وضعیت خودشون شهدای زیادی رو تقدیم کردند. مفهوم شهادت رو بایستی ما درست درک کنیم.
An important point is that the province of Ilam has given over 3,000 martyrs. Other provinces too have each given many martyrs in proportion with their population and their situation. We should understand the concept of martyrdom correctly, because martyrdom does not mean merely being a victim of the war. Well, there are many people who participate in wars and who are killed in their country's wars. Many of them are killed in defending the geographical borders of their country and remembered as patriots and heroes. Of course, some are mercenaries, but the rest are remembered, as I've said. However, our martyrs are not like this. Those of our soldiers who were martyred or disabled were not just trying to defend the geographical borders of the country. They were also struggling to defend the borders of belief, morality, religion, culture, and the spiritual borders. Of course, defending the borders of a country is a valuable act in and of itself. This has value, but it is not as important as both fighting for those important concepts and defending the borders of the country. Our martyrs are like this. If we want to look at this at a higher level, our martyrs are, in fact, the manifestation of this verse. Indeed, Allah has bought from the faithful their souls and their possessions for paradise to be theirs. The Holy Quran, Surah 9, verse 111.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
The International Criminal Court's decision to deprioritize a probe into crimes by the U.S. and its allies came after years of U.S. obstruction. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Alice Sperry, writer. This article is published under the heading How U.S. Derailed an Effort to Prosecute Its Crimes in Afghanistan. Stay tuned for more. The new chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, the only international body with the authority to prosecute individuals over genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes, has recently sought to reopen a previously suspended investigation in Afghanistan, but with a caveat. The probe would not include conduct by the United States and its allies, all of which have committed crimes that fall squarely with the court's jurisdiction. The court's prosecutor, Karim Khan, who has been on the job for just over 3 months, wrote in a statement that his office would focus exclusively on crimes committed by Taliban and Daesh. A preliminary investigation of crimes committed in Afghanistan since that country joined the chorus in 2003 had been underway for more than a decade before a full investigation was authorized and then suspended in favor of an Afghanistan-led process. That investigation included crimes committed by all parties to the conflict, marking the first time the ICC probed crimes committed by U.S. forces, which in Afghanistan include extrajudicial killings, drone strikes that killed an untold number of civilians, and torture. Now, if a panel of ICC judges authorized the prosecutor's request, the resumed investigation would deprioritize other aspects of this investigation, Khan said, an implicit reference to the U.S. and its allies. The announcement dealt a blow to victims, human rights advocates, and those who had placed in the ICC their last hope to see the crimes committed by U.S. personnel and officials prosecuted in a court of law. While many Afghans welcomed the reopening of a case that they hope will preserve the international community's scrutiny of the newly installed Taliban government, they warned that the decision would threaten the credibility of a court that has long faced questions about its ability to take on the world's most powerful countries. The ICC has historically operated with limited resources, with an annual budget of roughly $172 million paid by its 123 members. In a world starved for justice and accountability, the ICC's resource problem has at times become a political one, raising questions about how the court prioritizes which cases to tackle. In recent years, the ICC has opened inquiries into potential crimes and Israeli regime crimes in Palestine, and it has opened and then shuttered preliminary inquiries into acts committed by British troops in Iraq. All have faced significant opposition. The U.S., which is not an ICC member, has also long taken a hostile stance toward the court, opposing investigations into its allies, including the Zionist regime, and fiercely contesting the court's jurisdiction over U.S. nationals. U.S. officials have put extensive pressure on the court, the Afghan government, and U.S. allies in an effort to derail any investigation of American crimes. Under ICC rules, the court can open an investigation if a member country requests it, if the United Nations Security Council refers the case, or if it believes that one of the crimes that fall under its jurisdiction were committed within the territory of a member state or by nationals of a member state operating in another country. It was under that third category that the court claimed authority over the conduct of U.S. nationals in Afghanistan, as well as in Romania, Lithuania, and Poland, where the CIA operated black sites. The prosecutors had opened to find a receptive partner in the administration of President Barack Obama, particularly as the American public had widely condemned the war on terror tactics of his predecessor. But U.S. officials unequivocally warned the court that the opposition to the investigation of American crimes was bipartisan. With political opposition from the strongest party to the conflict, their preliminary inquiry in Afghanistan dragged along for a decade. In 2017, with President Donald Trump newly in office, Ben Suda finally moved to formally request the court's permission to launch an official investigation. In 2019, the ICC's pretrial chamber, the body tasked with authorizing a formal investigation, denied such authorization, an unprecedented decision that cited, among other things, the political climate surrounding the probe. Trump's national security advisor, John Bolton, had been fiercely opposed to the ICC since his days in Bush administration, and he encouraged Trump to threaten ICC officials with sanctions and prosecution, as well as to revoke Bensouda's entry visa to the U.S. The prosecutor's team denounced the scare tactics and pressed forward, projecting, outwardly at least, a continuing willingness to take on the U.S. The court's investigation of U.S. acts had barely started, however, and political pressure on the ICC was threatening to thwart other aspects of the probe as well. ICC prosecutors and representatives of victims successfully appealed the denial from pre-trial chambers, and the ICC's appeals chambers authorized a formal investigation in Afghanistan on March 5, 2020. In response, the Trump administration issued an executive order condemning the ICC and imposed sanctions on Bensouda and Mocho Choco, the first time the U.S. had ever taken such action against officials of an international body. Critics of the decision argued that deprioritizing U.S. and other foreign powers' crimes undermines the court's principle of impartiality and reveals a lack of understanding of the conditions that precipitated the collapse of the Afghan government in the first place. Liz Evenstone, an associate director of HRW's International Justice Program who focuses on the ICC, noted that Khan's decision, one of his first official actions, reignites long-standing questions about how the court chooses to allocate its limited resources. The work that the ICC does has to be meaningful, she said. For it to be meaningful, it needs to resonate and relate to victims' experiences. It needs to be perceived as independent. It needs to be perceived as impartial. Before it was shelved, the ICC investigation into U.S. crimes in Afghanistan was expected to focus primarily on the torture program, which was much better documented than drone strikes and other crimes. Those would also fall under the ICC's jurisdiction, but it's unclear how closely the court was investigating them. Critics of the decision to scale back the probe have noted that by essentially enabling impunity for U.S. crimes, the court risks sending the message to dictators, autocrats, and even other powerful democracies that they may get away with them too. Even as the ICC's effort to reopen part of its Afghanistan investigation could lead to justice for some victims of Taliban and Daesh, it is leaving countless others behind. It is also denying Americans an opportunity to see their own government held accountable for the crimes it committed in their name. While a series of public inquiries have shed light on many of the abuses of the U.S. has carried out during its two-decade so-called war on terror, there have been no significant criminal or civil cases against those responsible. This is as much about the U.S. as it is about Afghanistan. It's about Afghan victims, but it's also about the U.S. military and its deep and systematic problems. Americans who care about the U.S. should care about this issue.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, www.islamicnewsnet.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Yemen's capital Sana'a has hosted an exhibition on those who have lost their lives in the fight against the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. Thousands of Yemenis have visited the exhibition, which was held in the occasion of Yemen's Martyrs Week. The organizers of the exhibition highlighted the importance of unity among resistance groups in the region in the face of U.S.-backed aggressions.
The sacrifices made by these martyrs are great, and they came to end the injustice of the Yemeni people, and they are also a source of inspiration for various people to stand in the face of the invaders, and all the resistance groups should unite against the aggressors. Our martyrs stood against the invaders led by the United States and Israel and their Saudi and Emirati tools who seek to plunder Yemeni's wealth. The martyrs are from all segments of society, and this is evidence of the sincerity of the cause that they died to defend, and Yemenis learned from this occasion the values of great sacrifice.
The Saudi-led war on Yemen, which started in March 2015, has killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children. The war has taken a heavy toll on the country's infrastructure and pushed the war-torn country to the brink of famine.
People here say they will never forget the sacrifices made by those who stood up and defended their country against the Saudi aggression till their last breath. They say Riyadh's war crimes will not go unpunished, and Saudi Arabia will be brought to justice for its atrocities. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Afghanistan's health system is on the brink of collapse, partly due to Western sanctions imposed against the Taliban. Authorities say the sources needed to produce oxygen for coronavirus patients have run out, so as the supplies of many essential drugs. Hospital workers are struggling with acute shortages, while they have not been paid for months.
U.S. sanctions against the Islamic Emirate now mean sanctioning the Afghan people. When the health sector doesn't receive enough support, and Afghanistan's assets are not freed, people's daily life becomes difficult and health services would collapse. My demand as an Afghan doctor from world countries, especially those who have blocked our assets, is that they should have a look at the economic and medical situation of the people of Afghanistan and free the money. If the US has a problem with the Taliban, it must be solved through talks rather than by pressuring our patients.
With the winter coming, hospitals will receive more patients. But nowadays, nothing is free for them, and they hardly can afford to buy food and medicines.
Before the Taliban takeover, we used to receive food and medicines, but since the Taliban have taken power, there is no food neither for patients nor for doctors. There are a few medicines available here, but doctors say most of them have already run out.
As I witnessed, first of all, most of the doctors were absent. It is said that they are disappointed because they have been unpaid for months. Second, the hospital rooms are very cold. In addition, there is a shortage of food and medicines. Patients share their food with hospital staff. It is world countries' duties to send humanitarian assistance to the Afghan health centers.
After the Taliban took over, the U.S. froze some $10 billion in assets of the Afghan Central Bank. The White House last week dismissed any immediate release of the money. The freezing of Afghan assets by the U.S. has dragged Afghanistan into hunger and the health crisis. Afghans say they have been harmed by sanctions imposed against the Taliban. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Migration, an ongoing phenomenon, seems to be endless. Countries around the world have always had to deal with migrants coming from various destinations. A broad range of factors contribute to the movement of people, including economic challenges, extreme poverty, or conflict. According to the United Nations, around 281 million people were international migrants in 2020. That represents 3.6% of the global population. In recent years, the wave of migration has taken a different turn as Europe and the United States have become the main destinations for migrants. Large numbers of people have tried to reach Europe from countries in West Asia, including Iraq and Syria, both witnessing wars in which the U.S. and some Western states have played a big role. The U.S. itself has faced a growing number of asylum seekers trying to reach there from Central American countries. The root causes for that include economic crises blamed on U.S. policies towards these countries. Migration has also become a source of political tensions among countries, with the latest examples in Europe. Belarus and neighboring Poland are at odds over the situation of thousands of migrants stranded at the border. The UK and France have also locked horns over the rising number of migrants trying to cross the English Channel into Britain. All this comes as many migrants lose their lives through their perilous journey. There have been other destinations for migrants too. Iran is one of them. It hosts Afghans fleeing poverty and conflict triggered by 2 decades of the US-led military presence in Afghanistan that came to an end just this past August. Several millions of Afghans currently live in Iran, which, according to the UN, make one of the largest refugee populations. The world body has on various occasions hailed Iran for accepting the Afghan refugees. All in all, experts believe the global migration crisis can only be tackled through a concerted effort by countries and enough determination to end conflicts across the world.
On Thursday, the UN General Assembly passed a resolution on the situation of human rights in Iran. Pushed by Canada, the resolution expresses serious concern over, quote, alarmingly high rate of the imposition of death penalty in Iran, including those against child offenders. 76 countries voted in favor of the resolution, and 31 countries voted against it, while 69 others abstained. Iran's High Council for Human Rights was quick to deplore what he called a politically motivated measure replete with factual errors.
There is no international rule that bans the death penalty for people under 18. Furthermore, Article 1 of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child defines a child as every human being below the age of 18 years, unless the national law considers majority attained at an earlier age. Well, in the Islamic Republic, a child has a different definition. So it's not illegal in Iran to execute a person under 18. Yet I should add that the number of minus 18 people who receive death penalty in Iran is insignificant.
Tehran views the new resolution as a clear example of double standards at the United Nations. The Islamic Republic urged the international body to open its eyes to the devastating effects of U.S. sanctions on the health sector in Iran. Tehran says those sanctions have denied thousands of Iranians access to life-saving medicine.
Iran is the major victim of sanctions. The United States has admitted that it has put in place an unprecedented sanctions against Iran. Isn't this a violation of human rights? Then why has the UN stopped short of condemning the illegal and unilateral sanctions on the Iranian nation? If you are so concerned about the rights of few prisoners who have committed crimes against the Iranian nation, you also need to take into account the rights of millions of Iranians who cannot access medical supplies just because of the sanctions.
Tehran also referred the UN to Canada's track record of rights abuse against the Aboriginal people, particularly disproportionate violence against indigenous women. Tehran said these are manifestations of deep-rooted colonialism, which Canada has been practicing with impunity. The Islamic Republic called on the UN to avoid a selective approach toward human rights. It said dialogue and cooperation based on mutual respect and equal footing is the only way to ensure the promotion and protection of human rights.